In order for the system to change, the language needs to change, and that is how we're going to bring about the best in humanity. Thought-provoking conversation coming your way. I hope you have enough airtime for this, because this is going to be a fascinating conversation. So let's talk about language for a second. Language has played a crucial role in shaping our perceptions and actions, and recognizing the inherent potential within each individual can catalyze positive change on a systemic level. By reframing our language and discourse around human potential, we can foster a deeper understanding of our interconnectedness and the role each person plays in creating a sustainable future. Given the increasing presence of AI-generated language, the webinar emphasis is on mindful communication, which is especially timing. How can we use languages to build bridges rather to build walls? It also highlights the importance of consciously choosing our words and narratives to drive meaningful progress towards a more equitable and sustainable world. This promises to be an enlightening but yet thought-provoking conversation that will inspire the attendees to really drive language as a mindset, but also to help address ESG issues. Fascinating conversation, and I can't wait for your perspectives and your insights, and share your questions that you might have and what this particular conversation has brought up for you. We will be joined by a powerhouse panel, which is Dr. Adriana Mare, who is a physicist. She's a doctor, she's a scientist, and she's also involved in the Africa to Moon project, taking the first telescope to the moon. She's the founder of Proudly Human. And then she's also such a formidable force. She was one of the women from South Africa that was supposed to go to the Mars One project. And she's fascinated with off-world projects, and really hearing her perspective is going to be fascinating. And then we've also got Dr. Sana Ngidi, who is the HR lead for Africa for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and she's also SIOPSA President-elect 2024-25, industrial psychologist. And then we're also joined by our very own colleague, Kalnisha Singh, who is a developmental economist, founder of KD Strategies and Our Common Future. And then joined by myself, I am the founder of Conscious Lead Hers and of Carmen Murray Communications, and the host of the Carmen Murray Show, and thoroughly looking forward for you to listen into this unbelievable conversation that will change your view about language in so many ways. Enjoy.
Warm welcome to everybody. I'm super excited about today's conversation, by the way. For those of you, if this is your first time, as we say, we build the ark and they will come. We are going to take our time with this journey where we're going to have robust conversations, and hopefully this will grow. Share it with your colleagues, share it with your friends, and hopefully we can allow this community to grow. Everybody is welcome. This is really an inclusive place where we can take on all of the systemic issues and everything that we face in this world. So from my side, I would like to, before I introduce our panel today and what we were talking, so I'm joined by my partner in crime, Kalnisha Singh, wave for us. Kalnisha Singh is also the owner of Our Common Future, and she is really so involved at grassroots levels. And we've decided to join forces to try and put together this ESG webinar series. And as we're working on it, it's unfolding and it's getting super exciting, because last week I felt like I was in a rock concert in Tibet with distrust and trust, because we were tackling this conversation around trust with Paula. And, you know, trust can seem so you know, everybody talks about trust, but it's a word we use, but we actually really don't really understand it. And when we started pulling off the layers of trust and what that really means, it really left a lot and why we need it. Because the problem is, if we're not going to have trust amongst each other and start building that, instead of working together, we're going to start working against each other. So we need to start taking actions and doing what it takes in order for us to unify, in order for us to solve all of these complex issues in the world. Obviously, we need to start with ourselves. But I also believe that we need to bring our skills and our forces and our personalities together in order to make that happen. So Then also just to let you know that we have our next webinar with the Fave Popcorn, the futurist that predicts with 95% accuracy rate to the Fortune 500. She's a force of nature. She's from New York. And then we also have our very own Bronwyn Williams that will be tackling the future of sustainability and what they are seeing under their glass ball and how they are seeing the future playing out within the ESG world. Okay, enough with all the announcements and the house rules and what. Please put in your comments, ask questions if you want to know more. These ladies are all yours. And the more questions you ask, the more robust this conversation is going to become. And I will try and squeeze them in between as we go. Then I would like to introduce you. I think I'm going to start with Dr. Sanang Giddy. She is a force of nature. I also interviewed her on the podcast, where we were talking about her life story. And what a resilient woman you are. She works for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation as the HR lead for Africa, specializing in human potential. She is so invested in women and also driving inclusivity. Welcome, Sana. I'm like absolutely honored that you decided to join us.
Thanks, Carmen. I can listen to you talk about me day in and day out. Thank you for the opportunity to join yourself, Kalisha and Adriana, in this conversation today. I'm looking forward to it.
Keep shining and vibing because we are going to be like a flock of flamingos amongst the pigeons. I always say that we are professional troublemakers. We are committed to elevating the room and tackling the unjust. So everybody that comes into this arc is here to come and help us tackle everything that bothers us. So without further ado, Dr. Adriana Marais, I met her I think 5 years ago when she was supposed to go to Mars on the Mars One project, and I interviewed her as her final interview going to Mars on her birthday. And we built a wonderful friendship from that day, and we've had so many conversations around everything that we're trying to do within Conscious Leaders, and she also serves on our advisory board. And this conversation came up about language a few months ago, and it's been percolating with me the whole time because Adriana does challenge you with everything. Like she's not gonna, yeah, but I don't agree with this. Now let's unpack this thing further. So Adriana is a physicist, quantum physicist, metaphysicist. I don't even know what the difference is, but she's busy with her second PhD. She's busy with a massive book. She is doing the first moon project, the Africa to Moon project, sending a telescope to the other side of the moon, working with China, like heavy things that she's been busy with, and then also affording us time and Conscious Leaders. But also, more importantly, you're here today to come and help us tackle this topic of language.
Thanks, Carmen. I'm really excited about the conversation today together with Kalnisha and Sane. And let me say, I'm really, really excited about the work you're doing with Conscious Leaders. And I've been diving into some of the content. So for those of you who haven't looked through the other conversations that have been had so far, please do. I think what struck me the most is the bravery in being honest from one's own personal self. So I find it easy to be a troublemaker. So I'm glad I'm in good company here. You reiterated that because I'm going to kick off the conversation today with something that may be a bit cheeky. But yeah, I just wanted to say, listening to the other conversations that have been had with Sane and with Kalnisha and of course with Carmen, yeah, I was really impressed by the real courage it takes, I think, to be truthful about oneself and one's own story, and how that's a precursor actually to being truly objective and truthful about what we see in the world. So really looking forward to this conversation. And if I may I commence with my cheeky piece. So like many of us nowadays, when we are looking at something that we need to do, we consult with ChatGPT. So, right, Carmen told me about ESG, and it's honestly the first time I'd heard the acronym. So I went straight to ChatGPT and then inserted, let me be clear, inserted the request, please write a satire piece on ESG. And ChatGPT proceeded to give this, which I might say is even less diplomatic than I may have been, but Let me read it as the conversation starts. So this is hot off the press from ChatGPT 3.5. Title, this is what ChatGPT wrote. The ESG circus, where profits wear a green hat. In a world increasingly plagued by environmental and social issues, one trend has emerged as the knight in shining armor, ESG investing. But behind the glossy brochures and eco-friendly slogans lies a circus of contradictions where profits wear a green hat and sustainability is just a catchy buzzword. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the greatest show on earth, where environmental, social, and governance criteria take center stage. Step right up and witness the marvel of ESG investing, where the promise of a better world collides head-on with the pursuit of profit. First, let's meet our star performers, the E, S, and G factors. The E stands for environment, because what's more profitable than saving the planet, right? But don't mind the fact that some of these companies still churn out carbon emissions like there's no tomorrow, as long as they have a recycling bin in the break room. Next up, we have the S for social, because who doesn't love a good old-fashioned virtue signal? These companies talk a big game about diversity and inclusion while their boardrooms remain as homogeneous as a bowl of plain oatmeal. But hey, they sponsored a pride parade once, so that makes everything okay, doesn't it? And last but not least, we have the G for governance, because nothing screams responsible investing like a boardroom full of old white men patting each other on the back. Sure, they might occasionally slap a few wrists for ethical violations, but as long as the profits keep rolling in, who really cares about integrity? But wait, there's more. Step right up and witness the incredible feats of greenwashing, where companies slap a fresh of coat eco-friendly paint on their balance sheets and call it a day. Plastic straw bans and paperless statements are just the tip of the iceberg, folks, because nothing says saving the planet like a multinational corporation with a PR team on speed dial. And let's not forget our loyal audience, the investors. They flock to ESG funds like moths to a flame, lured by the promise of double-digit returns and a clean conscience. But little do they know, they're just feeding the beast, perpetuating a system where profit reigns supreme and ethics are nothing more than a footnote in the annual report. So as the curtains draw to a close on this grand spectacle, let's not forget the true lesson of the ESG circus. While it may be tempting to believe that we can save the world one stock at a time, the reality is far more sobering. Until we address the root causes of environmental degradation, social inequality, and corporate greed, ESG investing will remain nothing more than a sideshow, a distraction from the real work that needs to be done. Discuss.
Wow. I have no words for the first time. And here we say, in order for the system to change, the language needs to change. I don't even have one word that I can articulate. All I can say is, wow. Kalnisha, maybe you can spin that and tell us what your views are on that.
So it's really interesting. I mean, I think we've had the conversation lots of times that the sustainability movement isn't a new one, although I mean, hearing the way that ChatGPT presented the satire on ESG, we've seen the trends and we've noticed the trends over the last sort of 5 years, even more so in the post-COVID world, about everyone spinning their ESG stories, right? And this movement towards ESG as a sort of badge of honor, where, you know, companies and corporates and even countries are trying to present themselves as doing the right thing consistently. And that it doesn't, and doing the right thing doesn't mean that you've got to change your business models and the way that you behave. And we know at the same time as we listen to all of these stories, we wonder, you know, is that really the case? Can we carry on this pathway, wearing our badges of honor, the green hats? So can we carry on? And is that actually us achieving a level of sustainability? And we know at the bottom of our hearts and the bottom of our stomachs, that's not the case. You know, if we carry on this trajectory, regardless of all the rubber stamps and the green hats and the beautiful presentations, you know, we're not going to get out of this alive as a human race. So it really, really, I mean, and that's where the story of the language comes in. We've all been raised in societies where we buy the language that is presented to us. Like, we buy the languaging that is presented to us. We buy the marketing stories, where whether we like it or not, or choose to admit it or not, we're all consumers consuming all the language that is presented to us. And it really does feel like from an economic perspective, from a societal perspective, it's time for us to take a step back and start peeling back the layers of this language. Because this consumerist behavior, the sort of extractive behavior, is not sustainable, and it's not good for us, and it's not good for the planet, and it's not good for society. And I think that's why we're here, right? That's why we're having this conversation.
I think just how Adriana started is how I felt, right? When we spoke about speaking about ESG and language, it's kind of like, I think I'm a pretty smart cookie, but I also had to do a little bit of research. And that's kind of what ESG feels right like, right? It's to the average human being, feels a little bit inaccessible, feels like big corporate words, feels a little bit not something that you can individually influence. And I think part of how change becomes more sustainable is how do we ensure that that is embedded within individuals' understanding, within organizations, as well as how that influences communities, and how we go from just understanding ESG as this term about how we want to do good investing and how we want to be responsible, to actually how it's implemented, and do we actually build the understanding, the skills, the capabilities in order for us to be able to do so. And I think language is a very nuanced thing, right? When you read people's annual reports and you see what's happening on an ESG front, based on how the individual has reported it, the tone of it, how they've written their own specific measures, you could kind of spin the story the way you want to, right? Because there's like different, there isn't really a consistent way in which it's measured. And there's nuances by different regions, countries, etc. Organizational metrics differ, as well as industry. So I think just part of like, how do we make this more accessible and inclusive as understanding ESG to the individual and organization, as opposed to this big thing that exists out there, is important.
Absolutely love it. Okay, so I just want to bring this all back just to, you know, language, because I think it's important for us in order for us to tackle this conversation. I really think that we really need to understand language and what its power is. You know, last week, as I mentioned, when we spoke about trust, you know, it becomes very evident the more we start engaging in these conversations. We say that it's the era of soft skills, where we are all becoming soft, but the system needs softness in it in order for us to solve the problem. So if you look, for example, if a black widow spider bites you, that venom of that black widow spider is also the venom that's going to save your life when you do get bitten. Within the problem is the solution. And I think that we are always looking externally for how we can find solutions to all of these problems. So we wanted to actually look at language. And the reason I think it's important is because language is far more than a tool of communication. It is the heartbeat of our culture. It's the bridge that connects our emotions. And it's the thread that links us to one another. It is through language that we share our ideas, we share our dreams, we share our visions. But also, it is also the imports and exports of ideas and how we can connect our ideas and bring them together. And it can build walls, but it can also erect walls. It can heal or it can hurt. It can connect us or it can disconnect us. In yoga, there's this fascinating way of how they talk about that the breath is the language of the body. It's this silent dialogue that speaks volumes without uttering a single word. We do it every day, but we're not conscious about it. We just accept it to work all the time. And I think it's bringing back the language. And what is this language? What is this breath of the mind on our souls and our thoughts? Because everything that we think is something that we bring into reality, either for ourselves or in the world at large. How do we articulate our thoughts, our own languages, and how we're talking to ourselves, but also how we're talking to the external world? I think language for me is this vessel of wisdom. It is a way to transport ourselves into knowledge and insight. But I think also what's happening and what we are seeing is that words have lost its meaning. In the work that I do as an ethnographer, I can clearly see that we are suffering from word fatigue. Words don't mean anything if you don't have it backed up with action. And I think this is where It comes back to all of these words that we have created because we are so desperately trying to stand out and be unique and make money and wear all of these green hats. But these words that we are creating and these words that we are using is a collective experience. And it's time for us to start interrogating these building blocks of the words and how they are used. Are they actually the right words, the right meaning? So many times people would use words that actually, I'd have no idea what they're talking about, just on Sanae's point. And it's almost like you're frowned upon if you don't know those words or the verbose buzzwords. But in the end of the day, we are moving into a time that I believe we are moving into a time from where it's no longer about the words you speak. It is now about how you make people feel. We are now moving into an energy shift. So it's far more than just language. But I think that the language is also the catalyst to change. Anyway, Adjuan, I'm going to start with you.
Beautiful, beautiful. Love what you said now. So where do I begin? You know, as someone who's got a background in physics, I like to start in the beginning. So I feel like I need to go back to Karl Marx, who said that capitalism would eventually enrich a few and impoverish everyone else. But maybe that's too far back. Let's fast forward to the current circumstances in South Africa, where we're seeing some of the highest inequality on the planet, where we are grappling on a deeply personal and deeply current issue of infrastructural collapse. And I think there are many other indicators besides the reality that we're seeing here in South Africa on a global scale that our system is reaching the end of its current reign. So can we do better, I guess, is the question as we're looking out towards what the future holds. And let me say at the outset that I'm extremely excited and positive about the future, and in particular about the context with which we are looking at the future from South Africa. So I think focusing on the kind of centralized systems that we've relied on for infrastructure, for example, and looking at the very personal failures of these things when we don't have water in the morning when we wake up or when our power is off for days at a time, is a real important gift, actually, to start engaging with what a future system might look like, you know, because centralized systems are prone to failure. Nature knows this. Nature doesn't build centralized systems. Nature builds decentralized systems. And we can bring blockchain into the situation, but let me stay on track a little bit here. So thinking about how we can do better than the current system definitely does not mean reverting to systems that have existed before, you know, because the normal answer to what's the next system is like, well, communism didn't work. No, we need to build a new system with all of the historical information of the last 200,000 years of human evolution to try and improve, I think, which is really not hard on the current status quo. So back to the discussion about language, it's very difficult nowadays in this era of globalization to operate outside of the system. So, you know, just a few hundred years ago, this was not the case. So globalization comes with this amazing capability that we're engaging with right now of doing an online conversation with people all over the planet. But on the other hand, it has resulted in the situation where we are now all actively involved in the current economic system, whether we sort of agree with it or not. Mm-hmm. And again, to come back to language, let me give a few examples of language that we use, perhaps without thinking about the meaning. And I think recently we've engaged a lot with pronouns and all sorts of other applications of language and how people would like to be referred to, etc., and the power and the importance of the language that we use to refer to people. And this is a hugely meaningful conversation and a necessary one that has taken place. What I'm saying now is that I think we need to move this discussion to the language that we use to collectively describe ourselves as a society. One example of a word that I could bring up here is the word consumer, which Sanae has already referenced, or did Kalnisha say? Consumers, you know, if we are viewed as vehicles of utilizing resources and outputting waste, then, we've been reduced. What about the term marketing? You know, is the storytelling and communication and the human engagement that's involved in what a person doing marketing does, are we satisfied to reduce that to basically taking someone's product to sell it in the marketplace? What about human resources? You know, calling humans resources in the context of a corporate is reducing them to assets, things to be traded, things to be utilized. You know, being born into the system and being referred to as labor, capacity development. Are we nothing more than vehicles for some corporation or global organization to leverage our humanity in order to make profits? You know, I think the reduction that takes place in this kinds of language, we need to first of all acknowledge before we move on to how we may describe these things better in the system that we're envisaging in the future. But I think engaging with the language, yeah, is a critical starting point. But let me not talk too much. Let me gather my next thought.
I absolutely love that, and I would like Sane to take it, and then Kalnisha for you to tie this up, that we can dive in and get our hands dirty. But I just want to add something, right? I was taking a walk this morning, and you know this act of kindness when you see somebody and just want to say morning to them. Nothing expected, nothing whatever. But the moment you say morning to a person, oh, do you have something for me? Or do you have money for me? Or they want to sell you something or whatever. And what's happening is that I think that the system and this language that we have created, and also the currency, the money and transactions that always go hand in hand with it, is that we can't just be humans anymore. We can't just engage with people and say hello and have a nice, how are you, let me learn a little bit about your life, etc., without being felt like there's two hands being held out. I know it's very it's quite heavy that I'm bringing this up, but I do think that this language is this threat of this type of theory of complexity that we are facing. So Sane, I want to, based on that, I want to understand also from you, based on the language that we are using, like resources, marketing, I mean, hello, consumer. I'm like, oh my gosh, how do we change all of this? Like, how do we actually face this conversation within the corporate environment?
2024 and still your mic is off. You're on mute. I think for me, what comes to mind when I hear this is intent versus effect, right? Like the mechanisms framework put into place around ESG has got positive intent, but the effect in terms of how it's implemented is different. And if I go back to what Adriana read in that satire, it takes me to an example of employment equity, for instance. The intent versus the effect in terms of how it's landing versus you want to transform an organization versus is it actually transforming the whole system is completely different. And if I take this back into the landscape of organizations and ESG language specifically, if it's confusing and people don't understand it, it's that much harder for people to be able to implement it and for it to be able to be integrated into everything that the organization does genuinely and with the real intent, right? It shouldn't be the last thing that an organization does in order to have the right to trade or operate, but it should be embedded into the culture, the how an organization operates. And when we speak about systemic, it goes very much back to this can't be done individually, right? We're all influencing the external environment because it's all part of the system we're in. And what I experience in my own organizational context is the need for change, for influence to be systemic, to be partnership between governments, between organizations, between NGOs. So we all have a role to play in the system in terms of what's making improvement, and that cannot be I add to the system because of the benefit that I get. And I think that's where the environmental, social, I'm going to make sure that I invest as an organization, but I'm getting some sort of benefit from it in some way. It's helping me operate and trade in a beneficial way. But how do you do that in a way that isn't personally driven, but really around impact, I think is really important. And then if we think about the generation that we're in a generation where I don't think that they can see things like climate change, things like what's happening in changing sectors on labor, things around poverty. They don't see those things as separate and other. It's like how they live on a day-to-day basis. So how do we make that more accessible? And I don't think ESG can continue to just be something that a few are driving, but that we need to think about how everyone understands and leans in.
Sure. I think there's so much to say, right, Carmen? I think, and there's so many, I don't know, always nuggets of wisdom. The conversation around language for me, though, and I'm going to take it there a little bit, is that I think our language models, very much like the economic phrasing around human resources and capital and consumers and stuff, is very much imposed on us. I mean, like, we've adopted the models as the global South, as South Africa, as emerging markets have adopted the narrative of those economies that we want to be like, right, from an economic perspective, which means that we've adopted the models of the global North, of the West. And if we look at language, indigenous languages and languages of the global South, and I always defer to the East because I've done lots of research in terms of Eastern languages. And there's no literal translation for a lot of the concepts, just like there's no literal translation for the concept of Ubuntu in our context in South Africa, right? The impositions of the English language or the business language on these sort of emerging economies, on these emerging societies, indigenous societies, has caused a great disconnect, a great travesty. And where, I mean, Adriana says that, you know, we all participate in this economy. Our continent is kind of testament to the fact that we're not all participating in this economy. 80% of Africans remain outside of the formal economy. I feel the greatest travesty of the current moment is that we haven't taken the time or made the effort to understand the systems that most people in the global South are living by. There are economic systems. We call them informal economic systems, but they're like age-old traditional economic systems that exist outside of the formal economy that are unrecognized. There are age-old language systems that exist outside of the formal economy, formal society, that are not being recognized because we haven't, as a modern society, haven't made the time or taken the time or made the effort to understand those systems. And I feel instinctively, and as an economist, a lot of the solutions are in those systems that we have failed to recognize. Just like you say, the solution is in the problem. We're trying to solve for the displaced, the unacknowledged, the unincluded. I really believe that the solutions are there where we're not looking.
So the interest that's fascinating. There definitely is solutions, and actually, as you all were talking, I was reminded of this interaction I had with one of my friends. He's a climate activist, and I told him what I'm planning with conscious leaders and ESG and like trying to bring all of these worlds together. And I asked him for his advice, what he would say, and this was his response to me. And he said to me, "What you're trying to do is a bit tricky. It's a tricky task. You're negotiating corporate world with grassroots development and resistances. There is potential for really good resources to be extracted and funneled towards good causes, but it's a dirty stream wrapped in paradoxes and hypocrisy. That's something each person has to navigate themselves. I'll think on what you can study at this point," because we were talking about what to study, and he said, "Study climate justice," but he said, "It will help you to identify false solutions, market-driven mechanisms that don't actually deal with the root issues." And that for me was like, wow, like, what did I just get myself into here? So, Adriana, I mean, like, I think that you share the same values and the same views. Maybe you can maybe direct us also, you know, from a grassroots level, where the disconnect with the language is also happening on the ground. So many people are saying, and please hear me out, I hear that we're saying we need seats at tables, and it is important for us to have seats in the seats at the table, but we also need seats in the environments. We also need to remove ourselves from boardrooms and get on the ground, because there's a huge disconnect of what's being happening in boardrooms versus what's happening on the ground. And I think if we want to unify this world, we need to work together at grassroots levels and with people within boardrooms to shift that narrative and to change the world.
I would love to comment now on what Kalnisha just said, because I'm actually really, really excited about what she said.
Go, go, go.
But, you know, thinking about the role of language takes me back to George Orwell's 1984, which I read really long ago, but watched in the theater more recently. And, you know, that language is not accidental. It's not accidental at all. And that's why reflecting on it is so important in terms of thinking how we can go about creating a better system or moving towards a better system. So we're on the brink of many things as a society. You know, we're on the brink of expanding our consciousness beyond Earth. You know, we already have so much Earth orbit activity impacting the way we see our own world. You know, satellite imagery of Earth, for example, every time we use global financial transactions or navigate, this is using satellite technology. You know, soon when we have a perspective from the moon and then from Mars with people living there, our perspective of our own world will change dramatically. But yet we're on the brink of the breakdown of so many systems here on Earth. It's like it's all culminating at the same time. And as a naturally born troublemaker, just ask my teachers, I would like to kind of tear the whole system down. But this is my own flaw. We need to do something better than tear the system down, because we've got 8 billion people that rely on all aspects of whether we're part of the formal economy or not. You know, the access to connectivity, for example, is in the, you know, this connectivity is firmly in the hands of the system. You can operate from outside the economy, but then you can't enjoy things like the internet unless you are somehow participating in that economy. So there are many paradoxes and many contradictions. So how do we get to the point where, you know, if I explain the current system to a young child, if I could use one word to describe it, it would be greed. You know, open any economics textbook, and on the first page it says there's an agent who will engage in a transaction with another agent where they aim to optimize personal gain through that transaction. This is literally a fancy way of saying greed. To maximize your personal gain through your interactions with other people. And so I feel the system is fundamentally flawed, but I'm always stuck at the point where I try to say, how do we transition peacefully into a new system? And what is that? And what does that system look like? And I think what Kalnisha has just said now is such a moment for me to realize that this system is already in play. The system is already here. It's just not being acknowledged, because we are so bogged down by the vocabulary and the marketing and the propaganda, let's be honest, of the current system, that perhaps we haven't noticed that the new system is already there. And I'd love for you guys to give your opinions on that. But just back to South Africa, you know, I think the infrastructural collapse that we're looking at, I see as a great thing, because, you know, with 8 billion people all vying for resources on this planet with a system that's greed-based on a finite planet, like, you don't need a degree in physics to know that that doesn't end badly. Finite system, growing population, growing resource requirements, greed-based culture, it doesn't end well. However, and we're all going to face shakes, you know, shakes in terms of resources, disruptions in power supply, for example, you know, the Russian-based gas distribution system in the north, without going into detail on that, you know. And I just feel like as South Africans, we've been preparing for a disruption of supply chains or basic resources or whatever language you want to use to describe this stuff. We are used to having the carpet pulled out from underneath us. Take our power away for a few days. You know, some people live without access to grid power altogether. Take away our water for a few weeks. Some people live without access to grid water altogether. And we make a plan. And that kind of resilience that's been built into us over the decades and honestly centuries of living in this like highly difficult place to live, often incredibly beautiful and incredibly diverse in the people and everything else, But I think this has been a really, really important gift, basically, in terms of how we face the future, is to, you know, already start coming up with alternatives to the current system, because in no place is it more obvious than it's about to collapse than right here at home. And collapse is probably the wrong word, because it's not going to be like a revolution. It's already happening. And what Dr. has said has encouraged me to say that the solutions that we're looking for are already there.
Just listening to that, what came to mind was the phrase, until the lion learns how to write, every story will glorify the hunter, right? The language of the system and the metrics and how it's measured is by the vast people who are in power and like reinforcing what the system is. So even what Kalnisha speaks of, yes, it happens in pockets, and it might even be thriving and be what the future is. But if it's not the story that's told, there are many more of those examples which are leading to change, which is what we should be focusing on to have sustainable solutions that just don't get the time of day effectively. And so just thinking about how we reach the tipping point where it does become important for different voices to be heard. And then also, how do we use different mechanisms of communication, things like technology, for us to turn on our heads the system structures that have governed our systems in order to put some more disruptors in there? Like, how do we enable more disruptive voices within the system itself? Otherwise, we will continue on this path as we've seen happen in other areas of society.
Kalnisha, before you take that, because I think that this is going to, if whatever I'm going to tell is going to be like for you a big aha moment. But you know what? I recently attended a webinar by Henley Business School on ESG, and they were talking about so many companies that do good work, and then they give it to the press, and the press doesn't want to pick up the story because it's a good story, right? And my husband used to work in these, he was raised in the news industry. His father was involved in the Irish Times, and he was with the Times magazine his entire life. He was part of the news environment. And he always says to me, bad news sells, propaganda sells, fear sells. And this brings me back to what is also wrong with us as human beings that always want to be involved in the drama and always want to engage and vote with our attention in the negative things and not necessarily in the good things. And then we go, oh, but there's not enough good things happening in the world. But we are voting with our attention so that we can be served more negative news. And maybe that's also a disconnect, that we actually don't know what's going on at grassroots levels because it's not, it doesn't get enough eyeballs. Thank you.
I can see Kalnisha's mind going like this.
It's really interesting for me. Before I answer your question, Carmen, there's a really cool question in the chat. Where is the language disconnect? Where does it start? From Naledi. And I was like, let's give that a shot, right? I think what I see, and I mean, you mentioned I work at grassroots level. My formal day job is in local economic development. So we kind of trawl communities looking for economic opportunities to catalyze and sort of improve societal well-being in the process. And there's two things that struck me in my work, and we've been doing this work for like the last 21 years. A lot of the academic models around economic development that most of us working in this space apply assume and are comfortable with a 20% level of success. So if you've achieved 20% of your intention, you're deemed successful. It's Pareto. You make 100% effort, and if you get 20% success, then it's successful. And we all know that's not good enough. That's not even a matric pass in South Africa, which is a lot to say. And that's like, it goes to thinking about the system. So the system has acknowledged, economic systems have acknowledged that if you achieve 20% success, you're fundamentally successful. And it talks to me about like, why are we okay with that? And so for me, the question around where does the disconnect would language start? It starts there. It starts with this disconnect between, you know, self and work for me. So I wouldn't accept 20%, a 20% level of success in my own life in terms of my own goals. Why would I accept that as part of my work? And I feel that's the first level of disconnect in terms of languaging and languaging embedded in systems. The second level of disconnect I see in the work that we do, especially around ESG, is understanding what is of material importance for us here versus the priorities that are again imposed on us. So the example I always use, because it is controversial, is carbon emission abatement in Africa. So Africa as a continent, our net contribution to carbon to global emissions every year is around 3%. So even as a continent, if we achieved net zero, we don't come close to moving the needle in terms of global emissions. But every single company reporting on ESG in South Africa or on this continent is measuring carbon emissions. Why? Is that the most material environmental priority for us on this continent? Right? What we are not talking about is the reclamation of abandoned mine sites. We're not talking about the, you know, improving the productivity of our agricultural land and improving the food security situation. We're not talking about the, you know, soil erosion that's happened that's affected our water supply from an environmental context. So why are we not talking about those material priorities for us as a continent? And that for me is a fundamental language disconnect, right? And for, again, it comes down to, and if we look to like our collective and individual traumas is that are embedded just because of where we are and where we happen to be and the history of our continent and our country in particular. There are lots of things around language that are embedded in the trauma. And my example, my personal example is my grandmother would constantly tell me to like not ask questions, don't stand out, you know, don't be a troublemaker at school, because I was the only person of color in otherwise white school, right? And it was dangerous in her mind for me to stand out, to be curious. It was dangerous to be curious and it was dangerous to stand out. And how much of that kind of messaging is embedded in us, right? It's taken me a very, very long time and a lot of very expensive therapy to acknowledge that limitation and then overcome it. How many people have access to the resources that I had in order to deal with that embedded trauma? And that's like a third layer of language disconnect, stuff that happens inside that we're not necessarily dealing with, especially on this continent.
Sorry, just Kalnisha, as you're talking there, I'm just thinking like, to what extent, if you talk about the 20%, for instance, as a success metric, I mean, to what extent do we encourage organizations to speak about what hasn't worked, right? Everybody's writing positive stories about things which aren't going to have significant impact because we are putting forward a positive representation of what we have achieved, which could be the 20%. We're not writing the 80% of the story about what we didn't achieve because it was hard and because we needed different mechanisms and we needed to change things. So that doesn't get into the narrative because we are all showing positive progress in what we need to achieve.
And I think it's so important for us to, I mean, maybe not publish them, but at least talk about the stuff that hasn't worked.
Yeah.
Like, let us learn from each other's lessons. But that's a story for another day.
It's so true. But also, I think we as a society need to learn and environments, and we need psychological safety to feel that it's okay to fail. Because I think until we don't address that in the room, where we feel safe that we can say, hey, we didn't succeed here. This is something to do with me, but something to do with what is going wrong in our system over here. We can't have an honest conversation about it because it's all fear-based. Like if you don't meet your KPIs, this is what's going to happen to you. And I think what really saddens me, because obviously from a marketing perspective, and this is why I've pulled back quite a lot from the industry and decided that I really want to be the change I want to see within my industry and what I can do, is, you know, selling buy this, buy that, buy this thing, knowing that there's all of this chaos going on in the back of the mind. Look at quiet quitting. Look how people are actually, it's like this vacuum. It's like this quiet hum of people that are not as engaged with their work environments as they have been. And we can see it in ethnography. We can see it on search, because this is the hidden behavior that the corporates aren't seeing. And what fascinates me about that is that people still go and buy themselves the most expensive car, build up their loans, build up those, you know, instead of taking risks on themselves, because they just believe they don't have what it takes to create a better future that they can sleep at night. But the thing is, once you start engaging with, you know, you buy all these expensive things, you're not happy at your job, you can't speak about your failures, you have to speak positive about all the bad things that's going on, because there's no safety, nowhere where you look. Eventually, you become so trapped, and this is why society is so anxious, and this is why everybody is so depressed, because nobody's feeling free. There's no freedom. And there needs to be some sort of balance in that. But I'm going to let Adriana take the baton from me before I create too much trouble over here.
I think back to the question about Naledi's question about where does the disconnect start? So something in me says that the fundamentals of the system need to change, and that until we've done away with that assumption that an agent will attempt to maximize personal gain, everything else that we slap on top of this kind of fundamentally flawed way of living in the world is just going to be like putting a plaster on a gaping wound, you know, whether it's ESG or carbon tax or, you know, equality within corporates, or I don't know, whatever kind of campaigns and strategies are built. That fundamental flaw in terms of promoting greed as the driver of human activities, you know, what are we going to put in its place? And I don't have I don't have a system in mind that we're going to switch to, but I think what Kalnisha and Sana have said is that allowing the voices of people who already feel that they're operating or are operating from outside of the system is a great start to thinking about the kinds of mechanisms and organizational structures and so on that we need to start bringing in. But how do we address that fundamental assumption of greed? And I think, you know, I've worked briefly in industry, but my main training comes from physics. So let me talk a bit about what studying the universe has told me about where the disconnect starts. And I think the whole illusion of separateness is indeed an illusion. And if we, let me take you on a quick journey back to the beginning of the universe, and then back to the present. So did you know that 10% of your body is as old as the universe itself? So our bodies are mostly water, and hydrogen is obviously part of the water molecule. So 10% of your body by mass is filled with the hydrogen that was produced soon after the Big Bang. Hydrogen is not produced in significant amounts by any other process. So the knowledge that your own body is, in fact, part of the lineage of the universe, I think is a powerful way to start having that conversation. Secondly, the water molecules within your body are actually older than the sun. So I won't go into the details about how we know that, but the deuteration levels in the hydrogen atoms, extra neutrons, mean that our water was shone on by other stars. Our sun just hasn't output enough energy to have produced the ocean that we see. So therefore, our oceans are older than our solar system. Then when we look at DNA, you know, I'm talking about the interconnectedness of everything. So our DNA, we share in common with microbes all the way through to humans that walk this planet. We share significant portions of this code in common with the other living systems on this planet. We are not separate. We are all one. The universe, our solar system, our star, our planet, all the life on it, everything is one. And the language, of course, reflects this disconnect that we've somehow taken into how we see the world in the recent common era, to be honest. You know, early humans, I don't think, had this disconnect. They didn't have this divide. Maybe they also didn't have language. Maybe that's part of the problem. But if we look to the future and say, will there be corporations around? you know, will we allow the kind of behavior that we are seeing take place here, the damage done to our environment, the violence towards fellow humans and other life forms, are we going to allow that to continue? And if we don't have corporations in the future, what kind of organizations will we have? And I think if we look fundamentally at what can define an organizational structure, it's the hierarchy that we need to improve on. There is no hierarchy. We're all one. And so this idea that competition drives human progress is something that may, you know, competition may have got us to where we are. But I don't think we can afford to allow competition to continue to drive us forwards. That ends badly for all life on Earth. And so once we start seeing, you know, organizations as collaborative structures, perhaps without hierarchies, once we start seeing ourselves and our fellow humans as the same manifestation of life, once we start seeing the creatures who support, you know, our breathing would not be possible without all the photosynthetic organisms that cover the surface of our planet and live in the oceans. You know, without all of the living organisms on Earth, Earth is not the same place. It's teeming with life and it's one big network. And without it, there's no such thing as a single living organism. There's no such thing as a single human. There's no such thing as a single corporation. Mm-hmm. So I've hinted towards some of the language. I think, you know, swapping out competition for collaboration, not thinking about hierarchies, but rather vast networks of interconnectedness and cooperation. Maybe this is the direction we need to start going in.
I want to actually just to enhance that point. So this is a book by Faith Popcorn. She wrote this in the 80s. And this is why I'm getting a little bit excited over here, because she spoke about the evolution, the rise of women, and why it's going to be important. And everything that you've mentioned now, amongst all of you, in different shapes or forms, is the old think of how the system works that has been developed by the patriarch system. However, I also need to point out that we as women also have a tendency to contribute to the patriarch system, continuing the patriarchy, but that's a conversation for another day. But in this old system that's busy collapsing, it's all about working in hierarchies. Always need to know the answers right now. Role identity is about my title and who I am. Single-minded, resisting change, goal-driven, destination. It's all about how do I get to the destination, and it's all transaction-orientated. Whereas if we go back in time, who women used to be, before conditioning took place, women are collaborators. They work in community. They always want to ask the right question. And Harvard Business Review, I think last year, had a study where they said women are actually shaping the boardroom and the business strategy more than ever, purely because they ask more questions. They come prepared with questions. They don't always have the answers. They don't see identity in a role, but identity is divided into many roles. How do we know? Women hold space. They do so many things. Multi-minded, seeks change, process aware, always on a journey. It's not about the destination, and relationship orientated. And I think this makes me excited, because I believe that if we as women can rehabilitate and become who we actually used to be many centuries ago, we can work so well together rather than continuing the system that is collapsing. Come join hands, and we can actually change things if we just start embracing our feminine power.
And the men. They also have feminine power.
And no, I know the men have feminine power, but I think what I'm trying to get to. Yeah, I think what I'm trying to get to now, let me like get myself out of trouble here. I think that the system that has been built, we're all participating in it. It's not one or the other that's participating. But I think that we as women, because we're innately different and we design differently, we're complex and already in our own complexity in our system. We have, in 28 days, we have four seasons. So I think it's just for us also just to also recognize that we as women also need to get back to our roots of who we are. And there's a great book Kalnisha told me to read, Woman Who Dances with Wolves, and how women, you know, have forgotten about their power. And I just think that it's important for us as women also to realize that we don't need to be single-minded. It's not about the title. It's not about transaction, transaction, transaction. And for us to come together and collaborate with our counterparts, men are so important, and working hand in hand with them to change this world. And I feel that there is this big thing happening that's going to really change the way and build a fortified future. I think we've got one. We've got one last question, but it's quite long, and I know that we have to go because I know that there's meetings. But I think if we can just tie it up, Kalnisha, I don't know if you've had a look at the last question, just maybe tie it up with your closing thoughts, and then we can just do a reflection, and then we can go.
So, I mean, it's a question in two parts, the way that I've interpreted it. The first is, should we not look beyond reporting and figure out how to move these pockets of, so the pockets of success to normal, so mainstream the success? And secondly, how do we let more people participate and start developing their reflexes and participate in this narrative, right? And I think those are great questions, and I think the answers will extend beyond the realm of this conversation, because I think we really just do need to apply our minds and our thoughts. But I do think that the first step is to start contemplating these difficult concepts for ourselves. So I think us introducing the concept of language and languaging to shape a different future is very, very important. And I think that will, if contemplated well enough from an individual perspective, will probably send you down a rabbit hole of uncovering the layers and layers of how language has influenced our behavior and our society and our economy. I think my parting shot is, if we want to sort of reframe the systems within which we work in order to build a fortified future, we need to acknowledge what the current system is. And for me, and from an economics perspective, the current system is very extractive. It's exploitative. We take resources from here and we create value elsewhere. And if we want to model what a different future looks like, a more sustainable future, that it does need to be, our models need to be more generative. We need to, you know, take something and add on and add on and add on in order to create, you know, sustaining, lasting value and impact for everyone that doesn't deny anybody else of that value or impact. And I think that's what we need to contemplate on, and that's what we need to be curious about, is these new generative models of society, of community, of economy. And we start shifting language by shifting the language in our home. And I'll say that over and over again, especially for those of us that have kids. We need to change the way we engage with our kids. Starts, you know, selling a new message, new systems of messaging in our homes, in order for that to translate over time.
Any closing thoughts? Sana, I'm going to start with you, then Adriana, and then Kalnisha.
Yeah, I think I always take it back to the individual, right? So how involved can the individual be in driving impact and change? And part of that is making sure that people can name, speak, and understand in their own context. And as we've spoken about today, the language of the system isn't necessarily inherent to everyone or something that they can understand. And just anecdotally, this is like a little irrelevant, but when Kalnisha spoke now about families and kids and being generative, I thought of a simple example, like when you go to Woolworths and there's that tree with the bags, everybody wants to take a bag, but no one wants to put a bag back on the tree. And I think that's just that, how are you giving back as opposed to taking and personally benefiting, and organizations as well, like the element of what moves them forward. So it's a give and take, carrot and stick, and not generative. Thanks.
Adriana?
Let me not launch into a bunch of detail here. I think thinking about the system that we want to move into, a system that we can be proud of, a system that can respect life more than the system that we have now, needs to reflect who we are as humans. So if we believe that we are collaborative, generous, loving, And of course, all of the negatives that come with that. But if we believe that as humans, we are effectively and essentially and fundamentally collaborative, and if we live that sense of collaboration every day by making eye contact, by seeing everyone else as just another version of us walking a different path in this lifetime on this planet. If we look at the environment as also being part of us and that this whole planet is really just one big collaboration, I think then I can stop trying to be a physicist and actually design exactly what the new system will look like. Blockchain is in it, and I have done some work on this, but even for me, I think we don't need to worry about what the future holds. We are already building the new system. And when we reflect on who we are as humans and who we aspire to be, I think collaboration and cooperation is there. So I believe that we are already on a path to creating the new system, and conversations like this are an important way to explore that future. Thanks so much. It's been really great to chat with you.
Kalnisha?
So I don't know if there's much left to say. I'm really, really just very excited about these exciting conversations we're having and what it means for us in sort of maybe paving the way, maybe laying a foundation for everything that is to come. And I think we are at this critical point in like the history of humanity, right, where we get to intentionally make decisions that are going to create a better world for our kids, for our grandkids, for all the generations to come. And isn't it such a privilege to be part of that?
Absolutely. I mean, from my perspective, you know, the more I'm listening to everything that we spoke about here is, I believe that human beings are inherently good. I believe that we as human beings can reach our full potential when we become a little bit more curious and we go beyond the borders of our minds and interrogate things. Based on what I've learned today, is purely this, is that if we need to go to root causes, how did this problem arise? How did that problem arise? Maybe we should go back to, where did our language originate from? Our mother tongue, where did that language originate from? So that we can actually learn more about our own language, not just our language in our inner dialogues, but the language that we cross bridges and into various cultures with, and also to learn how our delivery also with our language can have such a severe consequence and maybe not bring out the passion, but bring out the fear, bring out the audaciousness that we need to see in society. And I think that this gives me a lot of thought about, I think if we start really interrogating the words that we use, rather use less words, and I will have a big problem with that because I'm a blah, 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 blah. I catch words everywhere until I can get my point across. But I think it's using less words, learn how to articulate oneself better, but also understanding the wisdom behind each of these words, because as we mentioned in the previous webinars, so much wisdom has gone lost. And just by a simple African proverb, you can land a whole concept like you did earlier, Sane. So I think it's really going back to the roots of wisdom and also just understanding the wisdom behind our language. All right. I hope that was helpful. If you want to join us for the next webinar, please do so. This is such a wonderful conversation. I have so much to reflect on. I really, I'm going to have to listen to this again. I think what we're going to do is we're going to publish it into the podcast. It's the Carmen Murray Show, Conscious Leaders, where we're going to actually put the podcast in there so that you can go and listen to it again and really reflect the nuggets that's been dropped. And feel free to reach out if you want us to explore any of this any further. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.